You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
Facebook discloses a cyber attack that affected 50 million users. A botnet is brute-forcing credentials. Cyber criminals show signs of ramping up spoofed retail domains in preparation for holiday shopping. The U.S. Secret Service warns of ATM wiretapping. The Port of San Diego struggles with ransomware. The U.S. SEC fines a company for cyber deficiencies. Mr. Assange goes offline. Andrea Little-Limbago from Endgame joins us. We discuss how cyber capabilities intersect with international statecraft and warfare. And some guy says he'll live stream his annihilation of a prominent Facebook page. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, September 28, 2018. Late this morning, Facebook disclosed that it had been the victim of a cyber attack. According to reports in the New York Times and elsewhere, it's thought that at least 50 million accounts were affected, with user information exposed. According to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's own Facebook post, the company discovered the issue on Tuesday. Attackers stole access tokens that would in principle have allowed them to log in to roughly 50 million people's accounts. He says they don't yet know if any information exposed in the attack has been misused, but investigation continues. The social media company has patched the vulnerabilities the hackers used to get the tokens, and they've invalidated the stolen tokens. Thus, if you find yourself logged out of Facebook, that's why. You'll have to log back in to regain access to your account. The company has notified the affected users with a message that appears on top of their news feed, so look for it there when you get back in. Facebook has also taken down the service's View As feature, which is the one that contained the vulnerability the hackers exploited. View As is a tool that lets you see yourself, or at least your profile, as others see you. The company has taken the additional precaution of logging users out who used the View As feature since Tuesday. Guy Rosen, Facebook's vice president of product management, blogged that the vulnerability arose from, quote, the complex interaction of multiple issues in our code, end quote, which he says stemmed from changes they made to their video uploading feature in July of 2017. The investigation is still in progress, of course, so there's not even a preliminary attribution. Facebook has involved law enforcement, and they want their users to know that they regret the attack. The story is developing, and no doubt more will emerge over the weekend. For PIEX Trick, a botnet with some worm functionality, is brute-forcing ransomware through port 5900. It finds vulnerable remote desktop protocol and virtual networking computer servers and runs through a list of commonly used credentials to gain access. Researchers at Security Scorecard say the payload is typically a Grand Cab ransomware variant. The holiday season isn't here yet, but it's not too early to begin thinking about retail security. Security firm Venafi is observing an unpleasant expanse of look-alike domains being registered with the apparent intent of duping online shoppers. When you do begin your holiday shopping, watch your typing and don't fall for an imposter's site. The U.S. Secret Service is warning banks that there's an increase in ATM wiretapping attacks that involve drilling a small hole in an ATM, inserting the skimmer, often with an endoscope, and then covering the hole, often with a little sticker that has the bank's logo on it. If you've got an ATM in your mom-and-pop shop, give it a once-over and pay attention to any warnings from the bank. The Port of San Diego continues to struggle with a ransomware infestation in its business systems. It's now been running for several days and seems unusually resistant to remediation. The business systems affected seem to be non-core and not crucial to port operations. Things like parking access, parking permits, public records requests, business document filings, and so on. The Port of San Diego surely includes a cargo and cruise ship handling port proper, but its remit also extends to the city's waterfront parks, shops, museums, convention center, and marinas. It's 34 miles of coastline, that's 55 kilometers for our international listeners, and the activities the port's responsible for pretty much cover the waterfront. In the first case of its kind, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is bringing an enforcement action against Voya Financial Advisors for poor cybersecurity. Acting against a company for deficient cybersecurity, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission has obtained an agreement from Voya Financial Advisors to pay $1 million in fines over violations of the Safeguards Rule and the Identity Theft Red Flags Rule. The SEC says this is its first enforcement action under the Red Flags Rule. After receiving some tough love from Ecuador's London embassy, Julian Assange has stepped down as the leader of WikiLeaks. Spokesperson Kristin Rafenson will take over. Mr. Assange is still in the embassy, but Ecuador's taken away his internet access. Ecuador's President Moreno is thought to regard Mr. Assange as an embarrassment held over from his predecessor's administration. The embassy has been looking for ways of encouraging Mr. Assange to move on, but the situation still seems to be a failure to launch. And finally, in a development we think is unconnected with Facebook's other issues, a freelance hacker in Taiwan named Shang Xiong says he's going to obliterate Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook page this weekend and that he'll be live streaming the hack. He says he's a white hat, and he may well be. But on the other hand, the word on the street is that he does seem to get himself sued from time to time. Stream if you dare, voyeurs of low tastes, but we'll be watching reruns of The Gong Show instead. It's a more elevated pastime. And that Chuck Barris was one dangerous mind.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. you need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
And joining me once again is Jonathan Katz. He's a professor of computer science at the University of Maryland and also director of the Maryland Cybersecurity Center. Jonathan, welcome back. You sent over an interesting article here about some Bluetooth vulnerabilities that the researchers have labeled severe. What's going on here?
This was a vulnerability that researchers found in the Bluetooth pairing protocol. So the pairing protocol, as many listeners might know, is what's used when you want to pair two Bluetooth devices. Say, for example, your cell phone with the communication system in your car. And what the researchers showed was that the underlying cryptographic protocol that was used to set up a secure pairing between two devices was actually vulnerable to an attack that would potentially allow an attacker to either impersonate one of those devices or potentially to eavesdrop on further communications between them.
The Bluetooth coupling used a mathematical concept called ECC, that's elliptic curve cryptography. What can you tell us about that?
It was a very interesting attack, actually. Although looking at the protocol as a cryptographer myself, it's the sort of attack that when you see the protocol, you almost immediately realize that the protocol was designed in a really silly way to enable that attack. Fundamentally, what's going on here is that the protocol was using what's called elliptic curve cryptography. And without getting into the details of that, let me just kind of say at a high level that this involves sending back and forth strings representing points on some mathematical curve. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't understand any of that, what it comes down to, what the attack boils down to, is that essentially half of that string was signed and the other half was not.
Okay.
And the designers of the protocol basically thought that by signing half the string, it would be enough to secure the protocol. And what the researchers showed was that by cutting corners like that, they were able to manipulate the second half of the string and thereby carry out the attack.
Hmm.
So I think in the end, you know, what it really points out to is the fact that you need to have security protocols analyzed by experts in the field. And in the best case scenario, you want to get your protocols validated and proven secure. And I think trying to analyze this protocol in a structured way and trying to prove security would have immediately identified that signing only half the string was not sufficient.
Now, but it strikes me that, I mean, obviously, you know, Bluetooth is not some fringe bit of technology. The folks who are in charge of validating these sorts of things, surely they would have had somebody look at this before it was sent out and made a standard, right?
Can I say no comment? You know, all I can say is that the flaw was there, and it's a pretty basic flaw. It's the kind of thing that I would cover in a graduate cryptography class.
Really?
So I don't know who looked at it, who didn't look at it. I think one of the things going on here is that perhaps people thought that because of the pairing protocol and because of Bluetooth in general is something that's carried out between two devices in close proximity, it's a little bit more difficult in practice to carry out the attack. You would need somebody, you would need the attacker to basically be within close physical proximity of the honest users, and presumably they might be detected. So the practical impact of this is unclear.
Hmm. All right. Well, the major manufacturers have been alerted, and they've done some patching and updates and so forth. So they're on it.
We hope so, and I hope that, and I'm sure it's something that's also easy to fix. And so I'm sure that the next versions of the protocol will address this vulnerability.
Jonathan Katz, thanks for joining us.
Great, thank you.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. you can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire Daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
Returning once again as our guest today, we welcome Andrea Little-Limbago. She's chief social scientist at Endgame, working at the intersection of global policy and cybersecurity. Our conversation today centers on how cyber capabilities affect international statecraft and warfare, the need to establish norms in cyber conflict, and how technical and policy people can do a better job of supporting each other's efforts.
As someone who has more of a political science background, but spends my time very much in information security, and we work at a cybersecurity company, the conversations are really quite different about the impact and the relationship between various aspects of digital statecraft, digital capabilities, and warfare and conflict. On the one hand, I'm seeing very much so on the information security and more the technology folks, the concern and the right concern of the militarization of the internet and how we're framing things and how increasingly we're seeing more and more of the full range and full spectrum of attacks, as opposed to the more utopian vision of what the internet can and hopefully in one day will do as far as being a democratizing force, help civil liberties, those kind of things. And so those are very, very important conversations. But when you switch over to more the political science conflict studies and warfare experts and policy folks, the discussion more so is looking at how the various range of cyber capabilities, and again, they'll focus more on, they'll call it all cyber. So even some of the terminology is a little different. They'll focus on how cyber is impacting warfare already and evolving really the fundamental and core components of warfare, such as even the notions of power. How is power shifting, and how is the internet enabling really completely new and distinct constructs of how we think about power during warfare? So it's a really different conversation that's more so looking at how basically it's taking it as an assumed, and again, I think that's also the right way to look at it, that various aspects of digital integration and digital capabilities are going to be, are already serving as a disruptor into warfare. But the interesting thing on that even is that within that community, it's presented more so as a future scenario, as how may it one day impact warfare? And doing some of my research, as you look back at it, it's really been over a decade now since various aspects of digital capabilities have already been influencing and integrated within warfare. And so I think that's something that is a little underappreciated and needs to be better understood. So again, so we can prepare both for limiting the militarization of the internet as best we could through norms and other forms of agreements on one end, but also making sure that we're prepared in warfare for what to expect.
Now, one thing that I've noticed, and I think noted as well, is that there seems to be this resistance to drawing any clear lines when it comes to, as you say, norms, when it comes to cyber conflict. It seems like world leaders are reticent to say, if you cross this line, then that is warfare. Do you think that's an accurate description of what we're seeing?
I do. And I think there have been some efforts at the United Nations, a group of governmental experts for a while tried pushing forth norms along those lines, and that fell apart last year as far as not even both in warfare and as far as what's off limits for targets, what's off limits for kinds of behavior, which still also helps establish some of the fundamentals, at least in peacetime. There have been declarations that the laws of armed conflict apply also to the cyber domain. That still seems a little bit somewhat nebulous as far as whether everyone agrees to that. There's a Talon manual that defines things a little bit more, but again, it's more guidance than a formal regulation or law. So there are these attempts at it in certain areas, but even a lot of those are very vague, especially if you look at it like in NATO, Article 5 now has a cyber attack as part of it. So a cyber attack on one is viewed as attack on all, but it still fails to define really what kind of cyber attack, what kind of effects might it have, would be the example that instigates the collective security of the alliance. And so it still remains very, I think states and leaders are very hesitant to really define that red line. For many reasons. One is, that means other countries or other actors will push up as far as and as close as possible to that line without, knowing that they may not have any repercussions for it. And then if you do have that red line, as we've seen this, you know, over and over again, just in traditional warfare, it then leads to a lot of domestic costs for leaders if it turns out that red line's crossed and it's not a popular war. So there are a lot of, you know, it's much more nuanced than just doing a red line or not. But you know, at the same time, we definitely need a lot more structured approaches and various kinds of policy advances to help us evolve and understand when these kinds of acts are should be treated and responded to with various kinds of statecraft, anything from you know, the range of non-kinetic responses, from the sanctions and persona non grata, indictments that we've been seeing a lot lately, all the way to when it should trigger a militarized response.
What do you wish that the folks on the tech side understood better? What messages do you think they need to know?
Yeah, and that's great. And I wish I had all the answers to that. But it's probably actually the interesting thing about this, I think some of it is starting to change. Mm-hmm. I kind of look at the breaking point or the sort of the inflection point of our elections in 2016. If you look at prior to that, really very few. There's almost people were accusing more of the national security folks of being alarmists in many of these areas. But with the election interference, I think that has started changing some folks to understand really the national security threats that are out there. But that would be the overarching one is that actually I probably have two different areas. One is to expand our understanding of how we even view or define cyber or security or information security. Mm-hmm. And this is actually a point that Alex Stamos made in a recent interview as well. We really need to expand to think about the full range of ways that you know information and various kinds of digital capabilities can be used by attackers, by adversaries. And so for so long within InfoSec, we focus really on the network compromises, the spear phishing, malware, so forth. And again, which is understandable, and that's that absolutely should remain a core focus. But when you look into the broader realm of cyber statecraft, if you want to call it that, you've got all the propaganda and disinformation, data manipulation, all those kind of things. And so it does get back a little bit into the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data. All that still is very, very true. But when you think about it broader than just network compromises, if we can think about it as that full spectrum, I think that really impacts how we will start to think about how to defend against it, but also how the people with the tech backgrounds and tech capabilities, what they can contribute to fighting that full spectrum of attacks as well. Increasingly, we're seeing in different examples, it's not just going to be a network compromise. In addition to that, the example that I like to give a lot is in Qatar, when there was the height of the tensions in Qatar, which there currently still is a boycott, but there was a hack of a state media site in Qatar, and then from there there was posting of disinformation on that media site, and then that disinformation was spread via Twitter bots, and there was basically bot armies spreading the disinformation, and that's kind of the adversary playbook that I talk about that I see occurring more and more is the integration of the disinformation with the hack, with the bots and the automation. And so that's what we need to start thinking about. How can we defend against those areas as opposed to thinking about them all as stovepiped? Because the adversaries don't. They think about it as full spectrum information security, attempts for information control. And so if we're not understanding how they're viewing it and what kind of strategies they're using, it makes it really hard for us to defend against that. And that'd be one area is just really focusing on those. And then just again, another area I would love to get more and more of the people with more tech backgrounds just talking to policy folks and vice versa. It goes both ways. So even just the more opportunities that we can have, like next year there might be a law and policy village at DEF CON. I think that'd be a great thing. I hope that happens. The foot soldiers doing the work for policy, within the military, within the government, within some of academia. In talking to them, there still is plenty of collaboration going on, more at lower levels of government and lower levels within the military. And so that actually made me, it was heartening actually to hear a lot of those examples that honestly just aren't, it's not sensational, right? So it's not going to make the press that, these two groups are coordinating and collaborating very well. That's just not going to make the news. So there still is plenty of collaboration still going on. And so that's the nice thing. Our democratic institutions are strong and our alliances are very strong. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hopeful that they can withstand some of the stress that's going on at the national leadership levels across the world. So we'll see, which isn't to say that we shouldn't be concerned, but something that I'm hopeful that we're resilient enough to withstand it.
Yeah. Interesting times, right?
It is indeed. Absolutely.
That's Andrea Little-Limbago from Endgame. There's an extended version of our interview over on our Patreon page. We'll have a link to it in the show notes for today's episode. Do check it out.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.